Welcome to Washington in Focus, your source for the week's top stories in the state of Washington. I'm Cole Lauterbach, managing editor for the Center Square Newswire service. This week, we'll be discussing new legislation in Olympia requiring new security measures for gun stores, who are warning that the regulations could put many of them out of business. City of Seattle officials are forced to take emergency cost-saving measures after new estimates show a growing deficit. A new proposal that would require the state board that deals with sex offenders to have a sex offender on the panel. And Spokane officials walking back an attempt to limit public comment after a lot of heated public comment about it. That's ahead in Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach.
Knowledge is power, and you deserve to know what happens in your state government. That's why the nonprofit Franklin News Foundation is bringing you straight news journalism through the Center Square, reporting on state authorities and publishing stories that show where your money goes and who spends it. By supporting the Center Square, you can track politicians' use of taxpayer money and demand transparency from elected officials. This is how we can equip everyday Americans to hold their government accountable. Become a supporter of Franklin today at franklinnews.org/donate.
Welcome back to Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach. Now let's jump into the headlines. As part of a national push to crack down on more than just gun ownership, Washington lawmakers are sponsoring a bill that would put new requirements on gun dealers to lock up their guns in safes at night and keep years of high-quality surveillance footage. Capitol correspondent Carlene Johnson joins me for this one. Can you give us a little bit more detail just about what this proposal would require?
Well, as far as Second Amendment groups and gun owners are concerned, this is going to shut down gun dealers across Washington state. HB 2118 has passed out of committee, not yet a full House floor vote, but it's moving that direction. Basically, they want to require gun stores, as you mentioned, years of video footage. Now, we know at this point that less than 0.17% of firearms that are stolen come from federal firearms dealers, but they're trying to make the requirements to lock up everything outside of business hours in a fireproof safe or vault. Now, many stores already lock stuff up, but a fireproof safe and vault is a whole nother deal. They're going to require at least 12 cameras running 24/7. To store that for even 5 years and 6 years, the bill calls for, would require, according to the National Shooting Sports Foundation, nearly 4,000 terabytes of video storage. To put that into perspective, it would cost the average dealer for just that 5 years of storage, $3.3 million.
Wow. Yeah, a terabyte, I mean, for people that are not as tech savvy, is one terabyte is a pretty good amount of memory, typically more than most computers have in them. So you're talking about an entire server full of just storage, video storage to keep all of this, as well as the gun safe requirement. Now, in terms of, you know, should this become the law of the land, survive the inevitable challenge in court, what is the punishment for a federally licensed firearms dealer if they're not towing the letter of the law on this?
Basically shut them down. And most of the arguments from the pro-gun side, including that gentleman from the National Shooting Sports Foundation who testified, basically said, this is duplicative. This is already all covered by federal law outside of the, you know, ridiculous requirement of, you know, 6 years of 24-hour a day video surveillance and then these, you know, fireproof safes. It's duplicative. He argued to the committee, at any point, ATF can come in, find some little violation and shut us down right there on site. No questions asked. That's already written into federal law. So there was one more piece of it that I found very concerning in the bill digest, the amended bill digest that did get through that committee. It said the attorney general may create, publish, and require firearm dealers to file a uniform form for all annual dealer reports required by different sections of this, and a dealer shall carry a general liability insurance policy providing for at least $1 million of coverage for every single violation. It's just
per violation. Wow. I mean, a typical business, an LLC, would have that level of coverage, just as a general coverage, you know,
right,
policy. But per violation makes it exponentially more expensive. I mean, the premiums alone there would also be huge. And much of that cost, too, would then also be passed on to the buyer, the, you know, people going into these businesses looking to exercise their Second Amendment rights. So it then, you know, I've seen this argument before in other states that this becomes a de facto extra tax on people looking to buy ammunition, buy firearms, you know, and that's a right granted them in the United States Constitution. And that was the basis of previous challenges to these laws, which have been enacted around the country, because this is a template bill, really. So, you know, in terms of what we're hearing from these firearms dealers saying this would shut them down, the supporters of this legislation, what are they saying in response to these dealers who say this is meant to take us out of business?
Well, I spoke to Lori Jenkins, House Speaker, about this legislation earlier this week, and reminded her, you know, of the what's in the bill, all those pieces. Do you understand this is going to put them out of business? And basically, we said, well, you know, at this point, the important thing to do is to make sure we have each and every one of these firearms dealers operating within the constraints of what this is seeking to do. Basically, conceding that, yeah, it's going to be onerous, and yeah, some of it's duplicative, but it's worth it if we save a life. You know, that seems to be the argument many times. It's worth it to save a life. But these guns are not being stolen. I'll repeat that statistic from the Shooting Sports Foundation. 0.17% of guns that are stolen. I don't know if that means they're used in the commission of a crime or not, but 0.17% of stolen guns come from federal firearms dealers. So right, this isn't happening all the time. It just isn't.
Well, and the argument, right, Carlene, is that the straw dealers or straw buyers, purchasers, right? Is that the thought behind all this? Is that there are, I've seen before that they, you know, supporters of regulations like this will say, oh, we know that a small number of these firearms licensed firearms dealers are selling to straw purchasers. And those are the guns that are getting into the hands of criminals that are killing people. And that's, you know, a legitimate gripe. But then the National Shooting Sports Foundation, the Firearms Policy Council, they're quick to remind people that this is straw purchasers of guns are an incredibly minute amount of total gun crime.
Right. And the guy who's doing that and selling out of the, you know, the back of his truck when there's the, you know, licensed firearms show going on inside the building, the guy selling out of his truck in the parking lot to give you a better deal, that's already illegal. It's already illegal.
Now, I know from context, California right now is working on a similar law that has already been a challenge is coming as soon as the bill gets Governor Gavin Newsom's signature. It's not in its final form yet. Illinois adopted a similar law in 2019, but many of the regulations that you mentioned, Carlene, after it was passed, were altered via rules negotiations between state police and the dealers, and much of them were walked back. For instance, it was a situation where instead of a locked safe, the fireproof safe, it was simply that the guns had to have barrel locks on them. So there may still be some negotiating even after the bill is signed if this does become law in Washington. So we'll see. Thank you, Carlene. Off to Seattle, where red buzzers are going off and the Kraken did not score a goal. The alarm is coming from City Hall, where Mayor Steve Harrell's office is taking emergency action to slow spending. Joining from downtown Seattle is reporter Spencer Pauley. Spencer, what in the world is going on in the Emerald City?
So Seattle is facing a budget gap, and that was originally estimated to grow to $221 million by 2025. But the latest projection that the city received now shows the budget gap to climb to over $229 million. This has caused Mayor Bruce Harrell to quickly inform city department directors that a partial hiring freeze is being instituted.
Now, is everyone on Harrell's chopping block here in terms of attrition, or are there, you know, like I've seen before, there's a bevy of exceptions in this where you're talking vital employees or public safety?
Yeah, so there are some exemptions, mainly being first responder positions like police officers, firefighters. They are excluded from the hiring freeze. This is notable because the Seattle Police Department is currently experiencing a huge staff shortage crisis. But there's also some other exemptions, including any vacant positions that already had an offer extended before January 19th. So that is also an exemption.
Have they indicated where the shortfall that they're looking at is coming from? Because obviously it's in kind of, you know, two moving targets in terms of revenue coming in and what are, as a municipality, the state's or the, you know, the municipality spending goal. Is it lagging tax receipts or were they overly optimistic about their spending, considering that they might still have had quite a bit of COVID money coming from the federal government?
We have to rewind to 2021 when Citi first said that it was experiencing some kind of budget deficit. This started when revenues were falling short of expectation, while expenses were increasing at a higher rate due to labor agreements, for one, a lot of wage increases throughout the city departments. So Seattle relied heavily on one-time funding during the pandemic. Once that went away, the city started relying on the Jumpstart payroll tax. And this payroll tax goes towards your big tech companies like Microsoft, Google, and Amazon.
Right.
But last November, the city decided to approve a 6.5% payroll tax hike to get those revenues up so that they can kind of use this to fight this budget deficit. Interesting enough, Amazon has kind of fought against this by moving a lot of their employees across Lake Washington over to Bellevue. And you're starting to see more of that to avoid, you know, these payroll tax increases. I think that's kind of expecting the city to see these revenues drop, which they relied heavily on for this. So I think that's probably
so a business is reacting to tax policy. I didn't think that happened. But anyway, right. In terms of then, you know, with when employees get moved out of the city of Seattle, what you have is an economic multiplier effect where they're no longer in town using, you know, local services, paying sales tax. They may not live there anymore because it's going to be cheaper to live in Bellevue, relatively, I guess. And, you know, all of that then kind of cascades down to the bottom line of the city's budget gap. Now, you had reported on this before that there have been talk of closing schools due to this budget fissure here. Now, the council had gone to some pretty great lengths to get around doing that because it's, you know, they don't want to anger the unions because obviously if you're closing schools, the unions are losing members. What was the last time that was discussed?
Well, that was the Seattle Public Schools District, which has its own budget deficit of about $129 million facing next school year. Now, that district is considering school consolidation as the main way to get over this budget deficit. Interesting enough, the city of Seattle is one of the lone entities I've seen where they've really held off from saying what they are going to do. About the main extent I've gotten from the Seattle city is that they are determining some jobs can be combined in certain departments, but they keep emphasizing that the city is currently analyzing all city department spending, but they have not threatened any budget cuts or any staff layoffs. I think in contrast, we can look over just at King County overall, saying outright that it is expecting its budget to be out of balance by $80 to $100 million by 2025. A big drop from 229 over in Seattle. But with that being said, King County Executive Dow Constantine already warned that there could be drastic cuts within county departments, and he basically blamed a quote-unquote arbitrary 1% cap on property tax collection, which has not been updated in over 20 years. Now, this is the difference between City of Seattle and King County kind of handling and blaming these budget deficits. But in all this entire region I've covered, a lot of budget deficits we're seeing based on one-time, you know, a reliance on one-time spending and this 1%
from COVID,
cap.
Right?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. They expanded, created more employee positions. And now that that one-time spending is out, we've seen this all over the country is that there's all of a sudden a budget deficit and nobody understands where it's coming from. And they're looking for, you know, more revenue to fill those situations. Yeah, so there are definitely other entities in the region experiencing similar budget deficits, aren't they?
Right, yes, absolutely. And it's just, it'll be interesting to see what the city of Seattle does here. I mean, we're starting off with hiring freezes now is like the big thing, but later down the road, I'm expecting them to say, like, we're going to potentially see some cuts to departments, some staff layoffs.
They'll have to get realistic eventually. Great.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Spencer. Appreciate it. Now for something completely different. A bill in the Capitol would require a convicted sex offender to be among the members of the State Sex Offender Policy Board, which would also consequently be renamed the Sex Offense Policy Board. Investigative reporter TJ Martinell has this story. TJ, who came up with this idea, and why would this be beneficial to have someone convicted of a sex offense on the board that oversees policy for sex offenders?
Well, the policy was sponsored by Representative Tara Simmons, who is a convicted felon and the first formerly incarcerated individual to serve in the Washington State Legislature. And her argument is that lived experiences and diversity will improve the sex offense policy board.
What does the board do? I mean, to give some context about this, that this lived experience would provide valuable, you know, advice in terms of forming policy.
Well, so what the Sex Offender Policy Board does is, at the direction or request of the legislature or a legislator, they come up with recommendations for the legislature to implement. They don't have any rulemaking authority on their own. And it pertains to conviction, how long, for example, a sex offense should, like what the prison sentence should be, and also what their restrictions should be upon release. So should they have what's called community custody, where they're just under state supervision once they're released.
Got it. So this is the board that gives advisement to lawmakers, presumably, to create legislation that would, they say, would better the situation between, you know, sex offenders and their relationship with the state. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay. Have they taken up a lot of those suggestions, or is it seem like they kind of make the suggestions and those to just go away?
They've taken up some of them. Others, they haven't. So this is one that was recommended by, there's been several recommendations from the Sex Offender Policy Board that the legislature, that at least this chamber has looked at. And there's another one that would end lifetime community custody for the highest risk sex offenders if they applied for it and were approved. So there's different classifications in our state. Level 3 is the highest risk sex offender, and it's not based on the severity of the sex crime. It's based on their probability of reoffending. And that bill would allow people who are classified at level 3, the highest risk possible, to apply for getting out of lifetime community custody.
Meaning that they would have no notification requirement if, say, they moved to Bellevue or Federal Way or Olympia. Who else would be appointed to this board, TJ?
A victim of a sex offense would also be, and both would have, they would also include organizations that represent both. So there's actually an organization in Washington State that represents people who've been convicted of sex crimes.
Oh, okay. So you've got, in this, if this does become a reality, you'll have a convicted sex offender as a member of this panel, and then also a victim of a sex crime serving and, you know, conversing and creating policy at the same table. Did anyone think that maybe having a victim at the table discussing policy with an offender might be a troublesome situation?
Apparently not. And what's interesting is there's no restrictions or stipulations in the bill as of right now regarding the sex offender. There is stuff about the victim, like doing some sort of like best practices or, you know, for trauma related stuff, but it means that the most violent rapist could potentially be sitting next to a person who was a victim of a sex crime as a child. And so that begs the question, why would a victim of a sex crime want to serve on this board and be around somebody who had the type of person that harmed them potentially as a child?
Yeah, to use the term triggering, I think would be fairly appropriate in this point. Now, this board has already brought some controversy on itself in the past that we've covered, correct?
Yeah, so they've come up with some interesting recommendations, and one of them was to end effectively some notifications or open meeting requirements for permitting for permanent housing for convicted sex offenders. So that and what I mean by that is the housing would be permanently used to house sex offenders in a community. And if it was going to be built, they thought, you know, we don't need community notifications that this is being permitted or being cited there.
So they're just, you know, a new sex offender would move into the neighborhood, and as long as this thing exists, there'd be no requirement for the authorities to notify neighbors that there is a potential, you know, say level three sex offender that just moved into their neighborhood.
So that's what's funny is the Sex Offender Policy Board didn't recommend that, but a sex offender can move into a community and then leave, and then there's no sex offender in the community. But if housing for them is built, it's like a military base. There's a permanent sex offender presence in a community, which is you know, it even more, I'd say, a more serious issue than having a sex offender move in who may potentially leave next week. The housing means that there's always going to be somebody there who's a convicted sex offender in your community.
Got it. So the notification wouldn't necessarily be that the sex offender's there. That they would get no notification that this was being billed?
Yeah.
Oh, we will definitely track this legislation. Thank you, TJ. Out the Spokane we go, where city council members have backed away from a plan to limit public comment to once a month after getting a bipartisan earful. Eastern Washington reporter Randy Brock has this story. Randy, could you explain what the initial proposal was?
Well, a little bit of background, maybe. The city council, the council itself meets every Monday night, conducts an open forum session for citizen comment toward the beginning of the meeting, and they allow up to 15 individuals to speak for 2 minutes with their comments. The proposal being considered earlier this month would have limited these forum sessions to just the third meeting of each month rather than weekly, but it would have expanded the number of speakers to 40 rather than 15.
So what was the reason behind the proposed change? Was there any specific events or, you know, circumstances that came up?
Well, according to official city documents at the time, the change was intended to increase opportunity for more diversity of speakers while freeing up the council to conduct its regular legislative business during the other three meetings each month. Unofficially, the proposal may have stemmed from circumstances that came up in mid-October after the council approved a resolution that condemned the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack on Israel and supported Israel's right to exist as a nation. Ever since then, the open forum sessions have been dominated by a dozen or so individuals who return each week. They voice their support for Palestinians and they condemn the resolution.
And agree with them or not, that's their First Amendment right, and they should be able to do that. So what transpired this Monday that's changed from the proposal and the current practices?
Well, actually, the council scrapped both its current policy and the proposal and agreed to a new procedure that continues the weekly forums. It actually increases the number of speakers from 15 to 20. It still maintains its two-minute comment limit, but it moves the forum to the end of each meeting rather than at the beginning. And that's so people who are attending specific city business can be addressed without them having to wait for all the commentary to end. The council also...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the council kind of agreed on a couple other things. One was to extend the forum sign-up. Previously, it was on just the day of the meeting. They pushed that back to the Friday beforehand, so that kind of opens up more opportunities. It's also looking at a process that would randomly select forum speakers if more than 20 people do register to address the council. The council also has a provision that there's no limit placed on the number of individuals who can address the council on special special legislative issues. It's just the open forum procedure.
I mean, they got it. They got it absolutely reamed. Randy, thanks so much. We'll continue to track that as we go, and it's obviously an evolving issue. So a big thanks to Randy and all of our journalists for sharing their stories. We're out of time. Stay up to date with all of these and more at thecentersquare.com. I'm Cole Lauterbach. Until next time, this has been Washington in Focus.